maintain any form of democracy without sanctions. The primary political sanction, or at least the one most readily understood, is the vote. The political vote has often been misused, and the people have on several occasions voted for the most extraordinary governments, including that of Adolf Hitler. It is inconceivable that any form of democracy in the political arena could endure without the people having recourse to an effective sanction. However, a careful reading of history will show that in every instance where political democracy was achieved by a society of its own efforts, that this had been preceded by a large degree of economic freedoms. A situation in which an individual must spend the whole of his time in pursuit of bread will never allow him to look up at the stars in the skies or the political powers that be and take an intelligent interest in them. However, economic slaves, whose services are less onerous, have never been able to achieve democracy. The Roman patricians used Greek intellectuals as slaves to educate their children. Their duties were not demanding. They were certainly familiar with democracy, Plato's Republic, and much more. However, their political impact in Rome has not ever been recorded as significant or great. The establishment of political democracy is always preceded by the development of basic economic freedoms. Economic freedom means a situation in which individuals are free to contribute or withhold their services as they see fit. Further, they are free to enjoy the fruits of those labours, and this right has to be established beyond the confiscatory powers of government or of any other entity in society. So history teaches us that political democracy grows out of economic democracy. Political sanctions develop after the acquisition of economic sanctions. If the political sanction is the political vote, what then is the economic sanction? The primary economic sanction of a people is exercised through what may be called the money vote. If one possesses a sovereign, then one has sovereignty with which to order industry to serve. Industry refers to the directions it receives from consumers as orders. Indeed, they are orders, and much effort, initiative, and enterprise goes into acquiring orders as an essential part of continuing any business. Those orders, which are given by the consumer, must always be accompanied by money in order to be effective. This money is voted by the consumer to the producer for the purpose of having that order fulfilled. Clearly, if one has sovereigns, one does have sovereignty. If you have a given number of dollars, then you have orders which you can place on various industries. We vote for one industry over another with our dollars. Money operates as a type of money vote, which is yours to direct industry to deliver goods where, when, and as required. A lady may direct that a particular handbag be delivered on a certain date in a certain city. A small boy may direct that a chocolate ice cream be handed over in Hyde Park on a Saturday afternoon. Any enterprise for which there are sufficient votes will prosper. Any enterprise for which there are thought to be sufficient votes will be attempted. Any enterprise for which there are insufficient votes will run down unless it amends its service to meet the requirements of the master, the consumer, armed with a supply of money. It is easy to see the power and the inherent sanctions that accompany the dollar. It is not so easy, however, to enfranchise the citizen with a supply of these dollars. A previous lecture to this one established the people's, or rather the specific individual's, personal claim to his share of the money votes created. However, no government has ever yet enfranchised its people with newly created money votes, and no nation has ever democratised money. On occasions, national leaders have consciously sought to move in this direction, and one such person was Abraham Lincoln. President Lincoln, at the outset of war with the Confederacy of the South, found himself in desperate need of finance, and on approaching the money manufacturers of his day, the banking system of the period, he was told that funds for government could only be raised at an interest rate between 24 and 35%. President Lincoln had the tremendous advantage of being a self-educated, honest backwoodsman who had learnt practically all that he knew by painfully expanding his knowledge from first principles. For this reason, he was not enmeshed in the macro and micro financial superstitions and dogmas of his time. He failed to understand that these dogmas precluded simple action which could finance his administration. Abe Lincoln went on to issue his famous greenbacks, and today few people understand the tremendous struggle which preceded and accompanied that action. The Appleton Encyclopedia, published in the United States in 1861, records something of what Lincoln had to say about that struggle and the future of the issue of money as he saw it. He was prompted to say of his struggle with the financial institutions, "I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in front of me and the financial institutions in my rear. Of the two, the one in the rear is my greatest foe." Abe Lincoln, on another occasion, pointed to what he saw as the correct direction for the creation and issue of money in the future. He said, "The money kings wanted 24 to 35% interest on loans to our government to conduct the Civil War. The monetary needs of increasing numbers of people advancing towards higher standards of living can and should be met by the government. Such needs can be served by issuing national currency and credit through the operation of a national banking system. The government should create, issue and circulate all the currency and credit needed to satisfy the spending power of the government and the buying power of the consumers." And please note this comment from President Lincoln: "The privilege of creating and issuing credit is not only the supreme prerogative of government, but it is the government's greatest creative opportunity. Money will cease to be the master and become the servant of humanity. Democracy will rise superior to the money power." While Abe Lincoln's efforts in this direction were terminated by his assassination, it could not seriously be expected in that period that an idea so confined to one man, or at least a small number of men, could succeed. Unfortunately, it is unlikely that a majority of people in any nation on earth could ever come to understand the simple fact of their economic disenfranchisement, or, if you like, their being swindled of their right to thousands of dollars per annum. At least, not until economic democracy had existed long enough for a public to understand it, expect it, and to treat it as the norm. No majority has ever understood a new idea. Changes as profound as this are only ever accomplished by informed minorities when society is in crisis. A change in the way in which money increases are distributed will sooner or later emerge as the only prospect of averting the economic dislocation of impossible debt. Once a nation determines to solve national problems with the debt-free distribution of at least part of the annual money supply increase, then the pass will most probably have been sold. This practice may then be expanded and applied time and again until it is regarded as a normal part of national financial arrangements. For this reason, during this segment, we shall be examining a proposal which makes no pretense at being the final answer. Nevertheless, it offers extremely significant interim solutions to national economies through nothing more than in the national money supply are put into circulation. This involves looking at a specific proposal. An Australian example is used because the pioneering work and application to a national economy had already been done for Australia and was readily available. This proposal has been fully documented in the publication What Has to Be Done, which is included as part of the extensive notes and documentation which are your entitlement as a graduate of this school. What Has to Be Done proposes a program of national recovery for Australia. The program has been applied statistically to several financial years, and the results have always proved to be similar. The year 1986 to 87 is chosen to demonstrate the national recovery program in the booklet. It might just as easily be applied to any other year. While the figures would be different, the nature of the result and the benefits of applying the principles is similarly borne out. Its claims are unprecedented. The program maintains that all sales tax could be abolished, that several consumer items like bread, eggs and milk could fall by over 50% in price, that inflation could be fixed at nil, that interest rates on all borrowings could fall to 5% per annum, or less, that household electricity and gas charges could fall by 40%, that local government rates could fall by 20% on average. Unemployment could be reduced by 100,000 jobs, and taxation could be frozen at its present levels, and the deficit could be completely overcome at no cost to any Australian individual, company, or even to government itself. In other words, it puts its neck out and could be regarded as ridiculous only by those who are unaware of the facts as presented in the previous segment. It claims that all these objectives could be achieved by redirecting the way in which half of the annual money supply increase is put into circulation. The program has been made available to every treasury in Australia, and correspondence is in existence between the author and some of these treasuries. In no instance was any government treasury able to successfully challenge the evidence presented. The program consists of 7 points. The first suggests the establishment of a full set of national accounts. This would include 2 accounts which no government currently maintains. It is extraordinary that while public companies are required by law to produce annual balance sheets, the entity which compels this, namely the government, never produces a similar account for the Australian nation. An Australian national balance sheet would list, on one hand, the vast assets of Australia, the homes, the farming lands, the capital value of the education of its people, and many other resources and assets, while on the other side, as liabilities, it would list the claims that exist upon these assets. This would reveal 2 matters of the utmost significance. Firstly, it would reveal the tremendous real wealth of the nation. Secondly, it would reveal that the greatest liability the nation has is money. Every Australian dollar in existence represents a claim upon the goods and services available in that country. While money in the hands of an individual is correctly considered as his asset, from the national point of view, every dollar in existence is a liability and a claim that must be regarded as legitimate and that ultimately must be met. The cause for democracy and decentralisation of power would be greatly enhanced if it was widely understood that money is created as a national liability. We would then be less inclined to trade our assets, our farms and industries, for national liabilities. The other account, which would need to form part of the national accounts, has been referred to in the program as a national supply and demand account. This account would list an assessment of the national productive capacity, given a full demand situation on the one side and on the other anticipated actual demand. This account would indicate the extent of any necessary monetary expansion or contraction. Under the second point of the program, the Reserve Bank, as the Central Bank of Australia, is directed to create and deposit in a special national recovery account a sum of money equal to the money supply increase in the forthcoming year. This action by the Reserve Bank in creating that amount of money would be done on a debt-free basis at a charge calculated to be sufficient to meet the cost of administration only. That is, something less than 1% of capital. In the year under consideration, that would have made available in a special national recovery account a sum of money approximating $14 billion Australian. Point three designated three initial ways in which that money might then be put into circulation. The first suggestion was that government might be compensated to the extent of $6 billion, which it was then raising from sales tax, to enable government to completely remove all sales tax. It was shown in a detailed examination of sales tax levied on items in the Consumer Price Index that this would have had an immediate direct impact on that CPI of reducing inflation by almost 3.5%. As inflation at the time was running at 8.2% per annum, this would have enabled inflation to be overcome for 4.5 months before any other expenditure from the National Recovery Account was undertaken. It was then suggested that the succeeding points, 4, 5 and 6 and 7, be undertaken. I will return to other suggested expenditures from the National Recovery Accounts later. The abolition of sales tax and the subsequent halting of inflation would allow us to proceed to point 4. This suggested that the sanctions of all Australian governments be co-opted to legislate a ceiling for interest rates of 5% above the prevailing inflation rate. Bearing in mind the inflation rate was now fixed at nil through the abolition of sales tax taking place, during the initial 4.5 months, that would effectively mean that all interest rates would fall to a point of 5% or less. Please note that this would not disadvantage lenders. In an economy of, say, 10% inflation and 15% interest, the effective return after inflation and taxation is less than this. Indeed, it may be negative. The impact of lower interest rates upon the economy and upon the inflation rate was also examined. At that time, the housing interest rate was 13.5%, and the impact of a reduction to 4% upon the consumer price index would have stopped all inflation for a further period of almost 3 months. Therefore, something like 7.5 months were inflation free. Of course, there were many other impacts on inflation, but to ensure understatement, all that was included was the effect upon housing repayments. Point five recommended a tax freeze. It suggested that the government could, in that non-inflatory environment, freeze its tax collections to those current at the time of the commencement of the program without any impact at all on the government's level of expenditure. Any government which maintains the same revenue in a newly created non-inflationary low-interest economy would be much better off. It was shown that even if only one level of government, like local government, passed on its savings from interest payments to citizens, this would enable local government rates to fall by an average of 20%. This, in turn, would again have a favourable impact on the inflation rate, taking the total period in which inflation had been completely overcome to 8 months. The sixth point of the program was of a largely technical nature, which instructed the Reserve Bank to use its normal powers to limit the increase in the money supply to that which was being expended from the National Recovery Account. However, it might be observed at this time that the savings in interest charges, which the Commonwealth could have enjoyed in such a non-inflationary period, would have been adequate to overcome the Commonwealth deficit completely, thereby stopping growth in the Commonwealth government debt. The seventh point suggested that the cooperation of all sectors of the Australian economy be sought to maintain a 12-month wage freeze in consideration of the foregoing benefits. It is unlikely that this would be difficult to obtain, especially in view of the fact that enormous savings in loan repayments, in sales tax and a tax freeze were already in place and operating. It might be noted here that these almost unbelievably beneficial results were obtained with only one expenditure from the National Recovery Account, with a view to abolishing sales tax. The program suggests that any further action which may be necessary to overcome inflation completely in the initial year might be undertaken along the lines that proved so successful in the latter years of the Second World War. Strangely, the only years in Australia's history in which inflation was stopped were in the last 3 years of the Second World War. Complete wage and price control had entirely failed to achieve this objective in the first 2 years of the war. The mechanism used by Prime Minister Curtin from 1943 onwards was to reduce the price of basic items by the application of something like a sales tax in reverse. When it became impossible for a production of a basic item like milk to continue without a price increase, then the government, instead of charging a tax on that commodity, would actually pay for a discount to enable the retail price to remain stable, even though the producer was receiving a higher price. After examining the rate of consumption of various items and their relative weight on the consumer price index, and the impact that might be made on paying this type of sales tax in reverse, it was shown that, for instance, the price of bread could be halved for an annual cost of $400 million. That one item would reduce the annual inflation rate for that year by a full 1%. In summary, then, it was shown that for 1986-87, the expenditure of a further $700 million from the National Recovery Account would mean that inflation would be totally removed from the economy in that year. It was anticipated that the money supply would increase by something like $14 billion in that year alone. If less than half of this amount, that is $6.7 billion, were put into circulation in a different way, it could achieve all of the benefits initially claimed, the abolition of sales tax and the complete end of inflation. In addition, all interest rates would fall below 5%, the federal deficit would be abolished, there would be no increases in debt, and the price of a good number of items like bread and milk would fall. Once these objectives were achieved, it would then have been possible, if the government still insisted that the money supply ought to increase by $14 billion, for other expenditures to be considered. An early retirement policy, for instance, may have been instituted if it was felt that the employment of the young was not proceeding at a sufficiently high enough level. It would have been perfectly easy, of course, to distribute the remainder of the $14 billion, some $7.3 billion, to every Australian citizen. It is not possible, given the limitations of this tape, to answer satisfactorily all of the relevant questions that arise in the program. However, a normal reaction from those unfamiliar with the subject and by whom it has not been previously considered goes something like this. Creating money? That's inflation. Well, no, this is not necessarily so. In an economy in which the production of goods and services is increasing in real terms, more money is a reflection of reality. Obviously, the practice of creating money beyond real productive advances would create inflation, so the concept of a supply and demand account has been applied in our second point. There is the greatest difficulty in inducing governments to discontinue the practice of creating additional national money in excess of genuine needs. As usually, it is to the government's perceived political advantage to borrow these increased funds and spend them in national vote-catching programs. There is a mutually beneficial arrangement between the banking system, which acquires ownership of all additional money on the one hand, and government, which through accepting this money as additional debt, gets national expenditure funded which is advantageous to them in the next election. This is done whilst the public requirement to make the repayments thereon is deferred onto the shoulders of some future government, which will do likewise. Governments which were constitutionally compelled to distribute additions to the national money supply directly to citizens would have no direct benefit available from irresponsible money increases. Such a government would be less likely to deliberately overexpand the money supply. there is one point of principle which must be made extremely clear. All money supply expansion ought to go directly to the individual for his own expenditure as he sees fit. The only acceptable exception is where these funds are distributed in such a way that they directly increase the personal expenditure of all the nation's citizens. Obviously, sales tax directly limits the personal consumption of citizens by appropriating that consumption for the government purposes. The use of newly created money to abolish sales tax directly increases the effective purchasing power at the disposal of citizens. Similarly, sales tax in reverse, when applied to a range of absolutely basic items of consumption in which all citizens partake, also qualifies as a mechanism which expands the personal purchasing power of the citizens. Obviously, the appropriation of any of these funds for public works, be they highly desired items like hospitals and roads and schools, or on the other hand, such capital expenditure as overly grand parliament houses or pyramids for the worship of politicians, must be regarded with some alarm. An irresponsible appropriation of the funds of citizens for purposes decreed by politicians, other than by way of taxation, is a very great danger. Years ago, especially during the presidency of Richard Nixon in the United States, there was a widely held belief that tax, price, and wage freezes must be able to defeat inflation. New Zealand adopted such freezes, as indeed did the United States. These measures failed. To those who had some background knowledge of the debt question, it was quite obvious from the first that they could not succeed. All of these experiments took place in an environment of increasing debt and therefore of increasing future repayments, and thus, as the increased impact of government, industrial and private debt began to mount, the demand for increased taxes, prices and wages became impossible to deny. In the final analysis, where the new money is distributed directly to the individual or is used to reduce consumer costs, the results will be the same. The reason is that both end the cycle of ever-increasing indebtedness without lowering demand below desirable levels. In any national economy in which the necessity for additional money supply does not compel government, industry or consumers to increase their debt, it is possible to achieve the results claimed. A minimum of cooperation and good sense on the part of the various sectors of society would suffice under declining debt to progressively reduce and ultimately end inflation, and therefore high interest rates and ever-increasing taxes, and to gain all of the other benefits which have been outlined in the program. The purpose of demonstrating what might be done is to offer an option which would enable any future government embarking on such a program to bring immediate desirable results. This, of course, would be most important in respect of the related political problem. Any government which could, within 3 months or so of being elected, bring about an end to debt increases, an end to inflation, a marked fall in interest rates, and the other benefits, would most definitely have community goodwill and support to proceed and continue with such a program. So too would the distribution of the national dividend be well received. However, such a novelty would no doubt bring forth from the uninformed and from the agents of those who now have the benefit of creating money dire warnings of inflation running rampant and the allegation that a national dividend is nothing more than a cheap vote-winning technique, the longer-term results of which would be disastrous. None of this negativism could possibly gain public credence in a situation where the long-term nagging worries of inflation, high interest rates, etc., had already been solved. The financial enfranchisement of citizens as envisaged has never been achieved in any nation. There have been national leaders, such as President Lincoln in the States and Prime Minister Curtin in Australia, who had a considerable understanding of associated concepts and were responsible for progress and the implementation of useful techniques during their time. It must be understood that it is not possible even for a Prime Minister or President to implement the financial enfranchisement of a people unless the population has an adequate understanding of the option to democratise money and bring immediate political support to the achievement of this objective. Democratising money will be the greatest political task of the 21st century. Preliminary to any possibility of the achievement of democratic money, a massive public education program is absolutely imperative. It is from the graduates of this course that the leadership of this undertaking may well be produced, as a focal point for all people whose growing understanding induces them to seek some way of being involved in the achievement of financial democracy. Why has no country ever done this? Answer: because never in history has the public of any one country understood that their money supply is simply created. In the past, of course, it wasn't always created. It was often produced in the form of various commodities or mined, as with gold. The cost of producing one sovereign was often one sovereign or even more. It is now, however, easier to produce $1 billion on a bank computer than one gold coin. Increasingly, and now almost entirely, the money supply is simply created, and no public has ever understood this. Once we do understand, then we're on the road to the correct answer. But first of all, that question must be discussed among all people of goodwill. Surely the present practice of creating huge amounts of additional money every year is inflationary. Answer to that question: since we have inflation, that is quite a reasonable assumption. Without wishing to go into a lot of technicalities, where the money supply is increased as debt, then it creates additional costs for its repayment plus interest. And then, of course, there are even more inflationary pressures. Where the dollar is simply given out without increasing the people's indebtedness, then the inflationary pressures of the future are less. The task of ascertaining what the correct money supply increase ought to be in any given time is important. We have already suggested a mechanism for this. Another query: why do governments all seem to create these enormous increases? Answer: part of the answer is that they generally want to buy your vote with your money. And to finance this, they normally go to the banks and ask them to create more money and lend it to them. That is called deficit financing. However, in a situation where the increase in the money supply automatically and by constitutional provision went to every individual Australian citizen, and where the government could not put its hands on it, we would get a much more responsible decision as to what the actual increase should be. Governments, of course, would be much more disinterested not having access to these funds. Consider some of the implications of the government's democratisation of money. Whereas the situation now is that every year a few thousand dollars are added to the debt of every family by way of consumer debt, housing credit, national debt, international debt, public and industry debt, etc., the implementation of this program would mean that the increase in the people's indebtedness would stop. This fact alone would have implications for the future that no man could possibly compute. As well as this, of course, there would be those checks in the mail. They would grant to every individual the sovereigns with which to enable him to take up sovereignty over the production system, to have it serve him as he thinks best. It obviously means a less pressured society. However, I would like to stress that the proper answer to this question is not any man's to give, except insofar as his share of the money increase is concerned. I could answer it for myself, but the really exciting prospect is that every individual would be able to use it in a unique and special way. This would offer fruits and benefits of which we cannot dream. For instance, someone may use it in order to enable himself to stop working for a time, in order to offer a public service from which another may benefit. Someone else may use it for music lessons, ultimately resulting in the creation of compositions, enriching our cultural heritage. And another's use may lead to expanding some area of knowledge, which will greatly reduce the need for slavish economic activity on the part of man. We know only that if we are brave and have enough faith to give our fellows freedom and that which is theirs, that it will alter the essential spirit of society. The real cost of enslaving or confining others is that we deny them the opportunity of serving us in all of those ways which are beyond our conception. So it is necessary to understand that true political and social freedom must be accompanied and even preceded by economic democracy. Economic liberty is a real possibility for the society that is willing to explore and apply these things. After all, hasn't our own recent history taught us that the prevailing approach to money creation and national economy tends to enslavement through debt? The application of your talents to the resolution of this problem is obviously extremely worthwhile.